Guardian Unlimited.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you all so much for coming. It's great to see the room so crowded tonight. My name is Rory McCarthy. I'm the Jerusalem correspondent for The Guardian, and I'm going to be your host this evening, and I'm going to lead us through a discussion with tonight's real star, Raja Shahadeh. We're also recording this event, and we're hopefully going to put a copy up on The Guardian's website. I know that there are some people here tonight who've known Raja for many years, perhaps even appeared in his books, but others of you will be meeting him for the first time. So for you, a brief introduction. Raja is a lawyer by training and one of the founders of Al-Haq, which is a prominent Palestinian human rights group that has worked for years on legal cases linked to the Israeli occupation. As a lawyer, he was involved in the peace negotiations in Washington in 1991, but importantly, he was not involved in Oslo. That's important because he has some very strong views about Oslo, particularly about where it went wrong, and we'll be talking about that later. Raja is, of course, also a writer, and I think it would be fair to describe him as one of the leading diarists of modern Palestinian life. He's been writing a private journal at home for the last 40 years, and in the past decade alone, that has produced three extraordinary books. First, there was When the Bulbul Stopped Singing, which is his account of life in Ramallah during the Israeli military operations in April 2002. He talks about the Israeli invasions, the effect that it had on people's lives, and he talks about samud, which is the Arabic for perseverance or steadfastness. It's a theme that he returns to quite frequently in his writing, and it's something we'll again talk about this evening. Next, he wrote a very tender memoir called Strangers in the House, which is about his family and particularly his relationship with his father, who was also a prominent lawyer and importantly a very early advocate for the two-state solution. Raja's family lived in Jaffa and fled in 1948 to Ramallah and of course have not been able to return. And this overwhelming sense of loss is something he explores in great detail. And then this summer, Raja published his new book, Palestinian Walks, which we'll be talking about tonight. It tells the story of some of the walks he's taken through the hillsides of the West Bank in the past quarter of a century. He writes about the natural world, the cyclamens, the olive trees, the springs, but he writes too about the encroachment of the settlements that have scarred that landscape and cut off many of the walks that he once enjoyed. It seems to me that in each book he's written, he becomes increasingly pessimistic about the future of the Palestinians. And in this new book, he writes about his anger and his disillusionment, and something that I found very striking, a continued and deeply felt fear that he has of being forced off his land. Raja's writing is lean and honest, and he comes across as a modest and humble narrator. But in his understated way, he also paints a devastating critique of the occupation and of the reality of life on the ground in Palestine. Not the lives of the people we normally hear about on the television or in the press, not the armed groups or the politicians or the desperate victims of some awful tragedy. But these are stories of intelligent, moderate, reasonable people whose lives have been so deeply affected by the history of the last 60 years. There's one powerful scene I want to quote from in When the Bulbul Stopped Singing, where he addresses this loss of control of the narrative, and he writes, "I have always insisted on interpreting myself, and now find all eyes of commiseration and pity turned on me, and words of condolences directed at me, determining what it must be like for me without waiting to hear from me and allowing me to say my bit. Everyone felt they knew what was good for me and no one thought of asking." Well, tonight we are going to be asking, and we'll begin with a reading from Raja, then I'll ask some questions, he'll read again, and then we'll take questions from you, the audience. So, ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce Raja Shahadeh.
Thank you, Rory. The book is a series of six walks, and the second walk is entitled The Albina Case. It's a description also of this important case. And for those who have the book, I'm going to be reading starting from page 52, but I will skip a bit. "As long as there were no Israeli settlements nearby, I could pretend that I had the whole of the hills to myself, a silent arena. The path I was on had once connected the villages north of Ramallah to those to the south, Many must have walked these same paths, not for pleasure, but for work, transporting produce and commuting from village to village. This had been the only way to move around before the paved roads were opened. Only recently did I learn from a friend that even these very paths I've been using on my walks are marked on a British-made ordnance map. I had wanted to believe this was my path, known only to me, my own discovery, that these hills were my private arena where I could be alone. I looked up the mandate maps and found that my friend was right. The path was marked. It stretched from Ain Arik, a village west of Ramallah, all the way down to the Mediterranean Sea. Normally, when I only had time for a short walk, I would continue straight down, and once in the valley, I would turn around and walk back up. Today, I had more time. Rather than continue down, I decided to head northwards, traversing the hill I was on and going down into the next gully. The further away from town I moved, the less cultivated were the fields, until I got to a hill that was covered with weeds. Here and there, hanging down from the stone terraces, I could see dead charcoal-black branches, remnants of the once vibrant grapevines that had filled these hills, cascading down over the terrace walls. I stopped to examine them. I could smell their damp rot. Nearby, I noticed a number of strange-looking rocks. I knelt down to examine them more closely. Protruding out of them like a relief were tube-like fossilized roots. I picked up another, the size of my palm, which was stuffed in the terrace wall. I noticed it because it was the color of the brown soil, unlike the gray rocks used to build the wall. I held it in my hand and examined it closely. I was amazed. It looked as though hundreds of shells of sea snails, starfish, and sea urchins had been pressed together to form this small, grooved rock. I had ventured into a fascinating area. Not far from the terrace wall, tall as an altar, I saw a large rock that seemed out of place, as though it had fallen from on high. It was cracked in a number of places. I rested my elbows on it and examined it more closely. The sun was striking it at a 30-degree angle. Engraved in the rock were two elongated lobes, one on each side, with a long mound like a giant toe between them. The whole thing was over a meter in length. At first, I thought these shapes must have been made by water running down the rock over many years. But why would the water make circular grooves? I had once seen pictures of dinosaur footprints. The similarity here was striking. I lifted my eyes and tried to imagine an enormous animal standing with one foot over this rock, its head almost reaching the top of the hill overlooking Ramallah. How brief a moment is given to us to be here on earth. And how beautiful was that moment then, with the hills all spread before me, not submerged underwater, not dominated by enormous animals, but full of wonderful treasures. Before moving away from this rock, I made sure to remember its location. Several terraces down from the pine trees, halfway between the top of the hill and the valley, in a field full of the common thistle called nettish, Proterium thorn, which was likely used to make the crown of thorns worn by Christ. Nettish is as plentiful in these hills as heather in the Scottish Highlands. Both are tenacious plants with strong roots. In winter, nettish acquires thick, narrow leaves that conserve water. The fields are full of small green mounds, not unlike porcupines. As the dry summer months advance, the leaves eventually dry up and fall off, leaving humps of wiry mesh that farmers sometimes cut and use as a broom to clean coarse surfaces of pebbles and stone. It's also used to drain water, and because of its elasticity, as a substitute for a spring mattress by people who are sleeping out in the open. In Arabic, the verb natasha means to pluck, hence the name of the weed extractor, mintash. In Israeli military courts, this weed has gained a great popularity. Never has a weed been more exploited and politicized, not least by Danny Kramer, the legal advisor to the Israeli military government responsible for expropriating Palestinian land for Jewish settlements. Danny's eyes would pop out if he should visit this hill. He knew few Arabic words, and netish was one of them. How often have I heard him stand up before the judge in the military land court and declare, "But your honor, the land is full of netish. I saw it with my own eyes." Meaning, what more proof could anyone want that the land was uncultivated and therefore public land that the Israeli settlers could use as their own? The other hero of the settlement project, whom I had heard a lot about but never met, was Rabbi Cook. He once described to his disciples how his identification with the land was so total that he felt his own body torn. It was not clear whether or not the land in question was replete with netish. Surely not. He was speaking metaphorically of much more profound things. It was the night of 14 May 1967, just before the war that resulted in the occupation of the Palestinian territories, the eve of Israel's Independence Day, and the anniversary of the UN resolution that gave the state its legal standing. As he delivered his sermon, he began to shout, and his body was rocked by grief. He was recalling the announcement in 1947, 20 years earlier, when the UN decided to partition Palestine into a Jewish and an Arab state. While the Jews in Palestine danced in the streets, the rabbi sat alone, bewailing the division of the land. He asked his disciples, "Where is Hebron? Have we forgotten it? And where is our Shechem, Nablus, and our Jericho? Will we forget them? And the far side of Jordan, it is ours. Every clod of soil, every region and bit of earth belonging to the Lord's land. Is it in our hands to give up even a millimeter?" In that state, he said, "My entire body shaking, entirely wounded and cut to pieces, I could not celebrate." When I read this, I thought, "God help us." But for now, I was not going to think any more of Rabbi Cook and his buddy, or of Danny and his legal fetish for netish. I was going to enjoy my walk.
Thank you, Roger. Let's begin by talking about your writing. It seems to me fairly obvious from your books that you always wanted to be a writer. And if that's the case, why did you train to be a lawyer? And how much do you think that's affected your writing? Would you have written differently if you'd never been a lawyer?
I made a decision early on that I did not want to be dependent on my writing. And I think this was a good decision, because if I were dependent on the writing, then I would have to please the mood of the market. And this I've never had to do, sometimes to my detriment, of course. But being a lawyer made it sometimes more difficult for me to write, because obviously, in a sense, I had two professions, because I was writing quite extensively. And at one point with Al-Haq, and I was co-directing Al-Haq, I almost had three professions, because Al-Haq took a lot of time from me as the organization grew. And I had the law and I had the writing. But the law and the legal practice has been extremely important in my writing. And in a way, I feel that in this book, the various trends or lines of my life came together, because I use the cases that I have dealt with in my legal practice and write about them. The other thing also is that writing is a very lonely business, and I've always felt relieved to have the office to go to and see people and experience things. And of course, these experiences always found their way back to my writing.
Did you feel that you had a duty as a writer to write about the occupation, to write about the situation that you found yourself in? Was that burdensome? And what was it like writing about the situation from within, from the point of view of someone who was living right in the middle of it all?
I think many writers around the world would, in a sense, envy a writer like me in a situation where you have so much to write about. However, it's not without its problems. One of the first problems is that the emotions are so powerful. The story of Palestine and how my family fled from Jaffa or was forced out of Jaffa, and the whole thing has been something that I felt so compelled to write about. And in a way, it was overwhelming that I didn't know how to handle it. And I did finally write about it in Strangers in the House, and there was a great relief when I finished with that. It's also another difficulty is living in a situation where there's so much injustice. You feel compelled to write about the injustice. And in a way, I did a lot of such writing, which was documentation of the situation, when I was working for Al Haq, and we produced many reports, and I also wrote many books that are about the legal situation and the human rights situation. But in my literary writing, I have been very careful not to write for as a propagandist, as someone who is trying to bring across a message. I felt that this would destroy the writing, and I hope I've succeeded in that.
Given that you felt so personally about this and felt so strongly about it, did you find it hard to draw a line between propaganda and simply advocating a strong argument? How did you make sure that what you were writing didn't come across as just an angry screed?
Well, I think that I've approached, first of all, it has been, I think as at least the kind of writing that I do, which is very personal and almost like memoir writing, you have to be very honest with yourself. And if you're honest with yourself, you realize that it's always, there are many shades of gray. It's not just one thing, and I've tried to reflect the shades of gray. I've also felt that if I'm overwhelmed with anger or hatred, then I can't really bring anything across. So in the process of the writing, there is also a process of psychological self-treatment. You have to make sure that you strike the right tone with yourself first, and then with the writing itself. And then, of course, also the question that I think any writer asks himself or herself all along is, what am I really writing about? And in none of my books was I writing about the occupation or the politics. I was writing about human relations, I was writing about growing up, I was writing about the relationship to the land, and how this changes over time. And for example, in the case of this book, how to reflect how beautiful the land is and how precious it is and what has happened to it.
Something I want to ask that we've talked about quite a lot between ourselves, and that's, you're writing, as you say, diaries, memoirs. They're about your life, but it's essentially non-fiction. And I want to know how creative you think you can be within the confines of non-fiction. How much of what you've written in this book is true?
Yeah, I think this is a very important question. And I think I have come to realize that once you frame a true experience, then you're turning it into something else. It can never be 100% true to life, because you're obviously representing a life, and through the representation, you are shaping things. I think in this book, I've taken some liberties at times. I've changed certain names. I write about a great-grandfather who lived in the land for 6 months out in nature. I knew the man, but knew him rather distantly. By the time I was growing up, he was already lame and never did go to the hills. What I try to do in the book is, through my own experiences of the hills and through what I knew about him, to reconstruct what kind of life he must have had in the hills. So it is not exactly history, it's not documentation of that person's life, but it is an attempt to represent it to the best of my abilities.
Let's talk about walking then. Tell me about the tradition of walking for Palestinians. You mentioned Saha at the beginning of your book, which I guess means something like to roam freely or to wander at will. And I have to say, I've always been slightly surprised at the idea that there is someone with his walking shoes on tramping across the hills of the West Bank, going past the checkpoints and the settlements.
There isn't amongst Palestinians a tradition of walking in nature. But as I was growing up, I always heard of people going on a sarha. And a sarha meant letting go, going without any destination. And I've always wanted to experience the sarha. And then when I started writing the book, I realized that every walk was an attempt at achieving this state of sarha. And of course, the book starts in walks in the late 70s and ends in more recent times. And as the time progressed and we had more settlers and intifadas and soldiers, the possibility that you could walk and be sure that nobody is going to stop you or harass you becomes less and less. In fact, the Sunday before last, we went to near the village of Telfit in the Nablus area, and we were stopped by settlers. And it was very unpleasant. It is amazing that for a Palestinian to wish for the army to come, because at least you know that the army is a little more disciplined, because these people in some outpost in nowhere are crazy, because they arrested us, literally. Of course, they had guns and pistols and dogs, and they couldn't believe that we were just hiking. It was not something within their... And they thought we were coming... We had photographers who take pictures of landscape, and they thought that we had come to investigate and photograph their settlements, and that this is against security, of course, security. And so when the army came, they went through the pictures. We had two photographers, and each had taken something like 400 or 500 pictures. So they had to go through and through and through and delete all the pictures of landscape. And of course, some of them were pictures of flowers and butterflies and bees. And still, they couldn't believe that we, once in a while, there would be a picture of the landscape. We didn't even have any interest in the settlements because they're very ugly and they don't picture very well. The book starts with the walks in the late 70s, and that was a really marvelous time for a walker. I've always lived in houses near the hills. So looking out at the hills is something that is completely ingrained in my memory and in my mind. And it was possible until the mid-90s to just leave my house and go off. I didn't have to be with others. I could be alone and not encounter anybody. A wonderful time. This is now impossible. And of course, as I write in the book, with Penny, my wife, we've had some really difficult experiences that have made me now avoid the hills around Ramallah. And when we do walk, we try to go a little farther off, which means we have to take a car.
Do you feel scared sometimes when you're doing these walks?
The fact that to get to the start of the walk, now we always have to go through checkpoints. And you never know in checkpoints what's going to happen. It keeps you on edge. And then the fact that there's a possibility that you would be stopped and reminded that, in fact, all these areas C, which is 40% of the West Bank, are prohibited to Palestinians without a permit. Not many people know it, and I try not to remind my fellow walkers about this fact. I think sometimes my legal knowledge is a detriment, and it's better not mentioned. But strictly speaking, if they wanted to be nasty to us when they stop us, they could say, you're here illegally. And the fact that there are so many armed people around of all sorts, you're kept on edge. And that, in a way, defeats the whole purpose, because the whole purpose is to walk freely and not to have to be worried about encounters, unpleasant encounters.
the invention of landscape. In the introduction to this book, you write, Palestine has been constantly reinvented with devastating consequences to its original inhabitants. And you talk about the different people who've come here over the last several hundred years. Tell me what you mean about reinvention, and do you think the land is still being reinvented?
Yes, I think this tiny area of the world called the Holy Land, even the name the Holy Land puts a frame around it and burdens us, has constantly been seen for not for what it is, but what it should be. So, for example, the early travelers, 19th century travelers and before, came looking for what they expected to see from what they read about in the biblical texts. And when they didn't see what they expected, some of them utterly hated the land. So it was very difficult to see the land for what it is, to see the people in the land. So many of these travelers never saw the Arabs, which is an amazing thing. And in a way, I was worried about being in the same tradition and not seeing the settlers. And that's why the book ends with this encounter with the settler. Because I think it's important to see everything, the ugly as well as the beautiful, and not be partial. But the question of what has been made of our land is a very, very important question.
When people talked about the biblical aspects of the land, it was the people living here were one of the elements that made it, that made that sort of biblical image. And yet they've been kind of excluded from the picture as well. How much contact, apart from these occasional confrontations when you're walking, how much contact as a Palestinian do you have with the settlers?
Very little now. In 1980, I was visited at my office by a settler from Ofra, and he wanted to engage my services, legal services. And when he called, I wondered, why on earth is the settler going to see me? In that time, settlers were all over Ramallah. And so he said, I want to engage your services and register a company, a local company in the West Bank. And I said, but you know, you're a settler, you're living illegally here. He said, but why shouldn't you be happy that I'm here? We will bring progress, we will bring business, we will bring economic revival, and you should be pleased that we are here. Well, I tried in a subtle way, because I didn't want him to take his gun and shoot me, that he was here illegally, and that. But I realized immediately this colonialist idea, which Zionists from early on claimed that it was their presence and economic benefits that brought Palestinians to Palestine, because before that there were hardly any people. I mean, this still lives on. It's quite amazing how persistent some of these things can be and how partial the vision can be. I quote in the introduction the advertisement to one of the settlements and how they describe the biblical landscape, which is all the terraces that were done by the Palestinians, the Palestinian villages, that they just see as God-given, God-made, I suppose, for them to enjoy, and disregard the fact that they were made by inhabitants who are living here and whom they are displacing.
There's nothing particularly new about these settlements, that the project, the master plan that you talk about a lot in the book, has been going on for many years. Can you explain a little bit about how you think the ideology of the settlers that we've touched on just there ties in with the sort of legal backing that they get from the government of Israel, and why it's been such a successful movement? Because it has, because there are several hundred thousand settlers now living in the West Bank.
You know, in a way, living in the West Bank is like having a terminal disease and knowing that eventually you're going to die, because from early 1980s, I was became aware of the grand plans, the Drobles plan, and the plans for the settlement of Israelis in the central region, northern region, southern region. I remember thinking that if these plans are fulfilled, then there's going to be close to Ramallah Israeli children born in nearby who would be raised in these hills, and they would come to love these hills. And then the situation would be immensely more complicated. And sure enough, as I describe in the first walk, I go up to a hill, which is a beautiful hill, and marvel at how wonderful the scenery is and so on. And then a year later, construction begins, and the settlement of Dolev is established, which of course created all kinds of problems for us, because of Dolev there is now an army post and we cannot get near. And in fact, just last week as well, there was something with the Jazeera International, and they were filming a walk near Ankinia, and the army came and said, "What are you doing?" We said, "Film about hiking. Is there any law against this?" They surrounded the area, put their machine guns around, and it was like a military operation. The big struggle for me, which I believed in very much, was the legal struggle, which was to defeat the assumption that by building the settlements, they're not taking anybody's land, that this is public land. And there, of course, in order to make that point, they were distorting the law. And I thought, if only we could prove the truth about the law and show the lie in all of this, we could make a big difference. I think that that battle, which I was passionately involved with for many years, and I write about one of the cases, has been lost.
Let's talk about another thing that you can do about the occupation. And one of the themes from your earlier books is this idea of samud, which means perseverance. And you make this very strong argument that small acts are done on a daily basis, are powerful and are significant. There's a nice scene in one of your earlier books, Strangers in the House, and you write about, Roger's writing about talking to Palestinian exiles in the United States who don't quite understand how life functions on the ground. And he says to them, "How can I tell them that we were heroic, not because of the great risks that we were taking, but because of our perseverance in the face of small, daily, persistent harassments and obstructions to our life, none of which on their own amounted to much?" And I wanted to ask, do you still feel the same way about Samud? Do you still feel that this perseverance is terribly important? And what has it actually got you? What has it actually achieved?
I believed that Samud was the most important thing. And in a strong way, I still continue to think this, because however you look at it, the main thrust of the occupation, main objective, has been to make life so difficult in all kinds of ways. Before the Oslo Accords, it was through refusal of permits to make economic activity or to leave the country or to get even a driving license. You needed permits for everything, and the occupation authorities, military government, try to make life as difficult as possible to make people leave. And yet people persisted. And I think, of course, now with the wall and the checkpoints, people are under extreme pressure. I mean, when you think that there are young men in their early 20s who for some, I was told by one young man at one point that for 7 years he hasn't left Ramallah. Now, Ramallah is not much of a big place. I mean, not for a young man who wants to explore, to go out, to enjoy himself, to see the world around him, not to be able to leave Ramallah for 7 years. I mean, it's inhuman in a way. The same is happening with the people growing up. My nephew and niece have never been to Nablus, for example, have never been to Hebron. I don't think they have been to Bethlehem, come to think of it. So how much do they know of the land surrounding them? I've tried to take them out for walks just to experience a little bit. But it's always been with tension, because as I write in one instance, there was an unexploded bomb. And I mean, there's always tension. So I'm not sure I've helped them love nature, because obviously children feel the tension in you. So altogether, I think the most heroic thing that Palestinians have been able to do, I think, is to, despite the harassments, the difficulties, the restrictions, to stay put, to hold on to their land. And I think ultimately, this is going to be an extremely important activity.
The government makes a very strong case that the checkpoints are necessary for security reasons. And it's quite clear that the violence of the Second Intifada has very badly damaged all of these sort of non-violent, legal you know, sort of peaceful efforts to protest and resist against the occupation. Tell me about your sense of the armed groups. You see them very faintly in the background sometimes in your writing, but they're not. None of your principal characters are from those groups. There's not. Why is there not so much detail about these groups and the effect that they have on your lives?
Well, of course, they do have an effect on my life. But I've never thought that it was going to be our salvation, that our salvation was going to come from the armed resistance. I think the stronger kind of resistance, the passive resistance, the kind of resistance that was practiced during the First Intifada, which was beginning to prove very effective. And I think ultimately there's going to be a coexistence with the Israeli public. And so you can't hope for good relations if you pass the wrong message. And I think the wrong message was passed to the Israeli public by many of these activities, which have been to our detriment. But at the same time, from anybody who reads and comes to know the Israeli plans for the occupied territories, realizes that nothing of what we see today has come about as a reaction for what the Palestinians have done. There were, as I mentioned, the roads, for example. The road map was already made in 1984. The plans for the settlements and how they would surround the Palestinian areas were already made from 1979 onwards. The zoning, whether for the area entirely or for villages in particular, was made in earnest from the mid-80s, and they were trying their best to finish everything before the Oslo Accords, and did make plans. Well, plans, it's not really plans, it's just making a circle around the villages with a felt pen and saying this is where the area of the village is and it cannot grow beyond that area for the next 40 years. So whether it is the checkpoints or whether it is anything that we're experiencing now, the Israeli government, Israeli authorities have been very good at exploiting the situation of violence that comes from the Palestinians to sort of pass through plans that they had already made long before.
Okay. Last question. I want to talk to you about the scene at the end of the book, your last walk, and I want you to describe that a little bit for us. Essentially, Roger has an encounter with an armed settler who's sitting on the hillside beneath Dolev, which is that settlement he mentioned earlier. And there's a polite argument, and then they sit down together. And in the book, Roger says something surprising about this encounter that I haven't heard very often before from Palestinians. He makes the point that the settler's understanding of the world is largely based on lies. In other words, he doesn't understand that the land that he lives on or has lived on for so many years has been expropriated from the Palestinians. And Roger writes this: "Yet, despite the myths that make up his worldview, how could I claim that my love of the hills cancels out his? And what would this recognition mean to both our future and that of our respective countries?" So can you tell us a bit about this encounter, and perhaps can you read the scene?
The last walk where this encounter is described is called Imagined Sarha. And so part of it is imagined. The part that is true is that I was on one of the walks in that valley, and I did come across a settler who was smoking dope. And we looked at each other uncomfortably, for their own reason, and didn't have the discussion that that I describe in the book. But I've had that discussion with many people throughout, and I've tried my best to give voice to the settler. And also, throughout the book, there were many encounters with the settlers, seeing settlers from a distance, thinking what they might be thinking, describing them from afar, but almost never recognizing their existence in the real sense. So I wanted not to be guilty of what I had described in the introduction that the 19th century travelers were guilty of, and wanted to give voice for the settler. Now, I think that our land, the land which both Israelis and Palestinians are living in, which is the Greater Israel, Greater Palestine, which I think is one land. We must never partition it with walls and ugly things, because it is geographically one land, and it's a beautiful land, it's a precious land. Unfortunately, those amongst settlers who are claiming a greater love for the land are literally destroying it. When you think that this land has remained hardly touched, I mean, you know, with little hamlets here and there, but nothing gigantic, over thousands of years. And then in the last 40 years, close to 500,000 people have come to live with the roads, with the infrastructure, the concrete that has been poured. I mean, it has been a devastation on the natural beauty of the land. And done not by people who can convince me that they really love the land. If you love the land, you don't treat it in this way. And ultimately, I think peace will only come when we realize that we have the fortune of being on this paradise on earth. I think this Palestine is close to a paradise on earth. I mean, it's a paradise in chains, but it is nevertheless paradise. And if we don't take care of it, if we don't learn to live together on it somehow, I'm not sure what formula will work, but we'll have to find one. We will destroy the land, both for us and for our adversaries.
Okay, let's have questions from the floor.
We were, as early, of course, let's say those early settlements, could we have taken our case to the court at The Hague? Since we were under occupation then, would it have been possible for us to do that?
The Hague gives an advisory opinion when asked by the General Assembly of the United Nations. And so it's not a case that any state takes against another state. You have to have an advisory opinion, and so you have to have a decision by many states. And this is exactly what happened with the case against the wall, and it could well have happened earlier on with a case against the settlements. Unfortunately, our PLO, the Liberation Organization, never realized the potential in the legal struggle and never used it. And so when we were thinking of the case for the roads, we did approach the PLO and made a brief saying how important it is to try and take that case. And there was some interest from some countries in sponsoring it, but there wasn't support from the PLO.
Jumana Awade. Thank you, Raja. It's, I read the book, and I enjoyed even reading it. I have a question and a comment. The question is that, yes, the settlers and the Israelis in particular, the occupiers, they don't admire the beauty of our land. But sometimes I see them that they do admire that in other places. If you go, let's say, to Tel Aviv, they admire it. They don't make it so ugly as the settlements look like. The comment is that 2 weeks ago I was in Harare, Zimbabwe. And the minute I met with many people, I was in a conference, and the people, the minute they knew that I'm coming from the Holy Land, I'm Palestinian, and they were so emotional. But they asked me, is the Church of Nativity still exist because of the war, the wall, the ugliness, the occupation? And I sense that in your book also, that the history can be changed, not only changed even, become as if it disappeared because of the ugliness of the war, or as in our case, the occupation. Thank you.
Well, I just want to say that the subtitle is Notes on a Vanishing Landscape. And I think when I was writing the book, I was in a state maybe of heightened emotion, because I was constantly dealing with this material, that I was sure that there's nothing left of the land. It's all gone, it's destroyed, there's nowhere to walk. And my wife, Penny, was telling me, well, you know, there still are places. There are some beautiful places that have not been destroyed. You must realize this. And I said, no. Anyway, I didn't even want to recognize that there were still some places. And so, in a way, again, the question that you asked about how the land is interpreted always, and we interpret the land constantly, it's true, because you can see it as vanishing or as having vanished in all its beauty, or you can see that still there are some places that have remained beautiful and untouched. And maybe instead of feeling that we have lost everything and give up, maybe we should concentrate on saving what can still be saved, because otherwise we would be so desperate that we would be unable to live with ourselves.
Hi, Reza. I wanted to ask you your advice or encouragement. Earlier in your discussion, you talked about two different strands, one about perseverance and the other, within the context of your professional legal career, about the limitations by the political construct around you. How would you encourage those in the West Bank and in Gaza now to persevere within the context of the political environment in which they live?
Perhaps the most important thing, that the way colonialism works, is it not only makes external changes and restrictions on one's life, but it also tries to imprint and impose and imbibe in the colonized an interpretation of themselves, of their history, of the present, of the past, and of the future. And I think the most important act of resistance is to remain with one's own. So, for example, many people now, without knowing it, accept some of the assumptions that are made about the land and about the occupation and about the interpretation of the past that is constantly being fed to us. And I think everyone has their own way of resisting, and perhaps the way for a writer or an intellectual is to insist that on the version of truth, on opposing the colonial mindset, which I'm beginning to see that more and more people are, in a sense, showing defeat by submitting, by accepting propaganda that is being constantly repeated again and again. Or, on the other hand, taking the other view, which is the extremist view, religious view, seeing everything in terms of what is written, and they say there's no way out. It has been written in the Holy Book that there will never be peace in this land, and that we are doomed to eternal fights, which is just as bad. I think losing the sense of one's freedom and ability to change things is the utmost of defeat.
On that slightly pessimistic note, we should wrap it up. Thank you very much for coming along. And to Roger, you know, I would like to encourage you to keep going on your walks, although the more you talk about it, the more anxious I become about these confrontations you keep having with the settlers and the Israeli military. So
one must not give up.
Don't give up. Yeah, indeed. But take care. And thank you very much, Roger. It's been a great pleasure, as always.
Thank you.
Guardian Unlimited.